It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a program that promotes the mental health of police officers in the Kenosha Police Department. A dozen years ago, the department was shaken, losing two officers to suicide, and it marked a turning point, according to a U.S. Justice Department report last year on Kenosha's suicide prevention, calling it a model agency for promoting comprehensive mental health. Officer Felicia Labator coordinates the peer support program. She is also the mother of Clay Davison, who was 16 when he died by suicide. A new documentary focuses on the Labator family and Clay's friend, L.A. Dodgers infielder Gavin Lux, who went back to Kenosha to reflect on the painful memory.
At the time, I don't think steroids was a thought. There might have been some other drug or some alcohol use. I remember being concerned. Looking back at it, it's hard for us as his friend group that we didn't kind of step in and say, hey, man, like, let's keep you on the straight path.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, call 988, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Officer Felicia Labator, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. As you look at this documentary and watch it and think about the life of Clay, your son, what goes through your mind?
You know, it's all over the place, really, as you can imagine, as a mother that loses her child to suicide. But I think the main focus that my family has tried to do is try to pick up the pieces and just truly live our life and help anyone that's near us, because so many people struggle with mental health and suicide thoughts. Not just in law enforcement, but obviously those are the calls that we go to help people. And so I guess I'm just so proud of this piece that Backstage Dodgers did. And I'm so proud of Gavin for, you know, using his platform to bring awareness to mental health, because there's so much stigma still that surrounds it. So I'm just proud. I'm proud of who Clay was, and I'm proud of how our family has come through this. And I'm proud of the Kenosha Police Department and, you know, us leading the charge and saying it's okay if you need help.
What does it mean to stay connected with Gavin Lux and other friends of Clay's as they lead their lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. You know, he kind of references in the documentary that, you know, I'm like a second mom to him and Clay's whole friend group. I am constantly texting them and checking on them and, you know, seeing where their life is headed, because it's part of Clay. They were him and he was them. And so it's exciting to see them, you know, grow up and do adulting now.
I would imagine too, it's really difficult to look at them as a group or see them all together as we see in the documentary and realize that there is one friend missing there. And I mean, he would be taller and he would be, as you said, doing adult things. As you stay close to this group, how difficult is that to reconcile?
You know, all of them, you know, feel like Clay is still with them, even though he's physically not with them. And so I think that is what truly helps. I've always felt that way, and they feel that way too. And Clay's number was 44, and you know what? He just kind of shows up. Like in the times when we need him, we feel like he's with us. You know, Gavin talks about having his tattoo of Clay on his arm, and he says that he wanted Clay to be on every field that he goes on with him. Mm. And I just think that's how we look at it, that he is still with us.
We're talking about suicide prevention and mental health support. Felicia Labator is the peer support coordinator for the Kenosha Police Department, mother of the late Clay Davison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's turn and look at your professional life. You were a detective with the Kenosha Police Department when Clay died. How did your work and your focus change after his death?
So, yeah. I was a detective in sensitive crimes, and in 2010, you had mentioned that we had lost two officers here to suicide, And at that time, our chief, John Morrissey, decided that he wanted to put together a peer support program. And he had asked if I wanted to lead it and also be a detective. And of course, I said yes. And so I was actually leading this team and doing the, you know, detective work at the same time. And then when Clay died, my work shifted to really just doing all of this prevention type work of not only within our department, but also just around Wisconsin. So it's a privilege and an honor to be able to help people in their darkest, darkest times. You know, that's why I wanted to be a police officer in the first place. And now it's just shifted to being able to, from the citizens of Kenosha to my own officers.
Can you take us inside the team? How does the peer support team work? What is that like?
So basically, it's a shared personal or professional experience. It's been shown that officers are more likely to open up and talk to somebody that they work with than going to see a therapist. And we're, of course, shifting that. So it's confidential. It stays between the people that are trained. We have a mental wellness coordinator that is above our team that we could go to, who is a trained licensed therapist. So we can get direction from her. So it just works out for law enforcement to be able to really connect with each other and say what they have going on. Because as you can imagine, going to these types of calls and scenes and coming through what Kenosha went through in 2020, there was a lot, not only for the officers, but their families, their children, and we support all of them.
When I think of the Kenosha Police Department, it is the police shooting of Jacob Blake in 2020. What was and is the role of your peer support team after Jacob Blake was shot by a white officer, after the protests that were sparked by this incident?
You know, and the whole defund the law enforcement was happening prior to that, and that, you know, can shake your world. Could you imagine if suddenly there was a defund radio, right? Like, this is what you do. And you could easily go down a rabbit hole and feel like the world was against you. Yet we knew that we had so many supporters in our community because of our good relationships that we do have with our community. But it was a hard, difficult time. You know, it's no secret that law enforcement across the country, the numbers have been dwindling. It's a hard job to get into. And so that's what we just try to do. Just be a great listening ear for our fellow officers.
Do officers worry that there will be rumors circulating in the police department that they are getting therapy or getting assistance through your team?
No, you know what we do is when we have a success story, we have that person see if they're willing to stand up and kind of share their own journey of what they've been going through. And so it's really helpful because they see somebody that they respect, somebody that they admire, and they stand up and say, hey, I didn't have it all together. I went to therapy. I got help and I'm much better now. My family's much better now. So we really get a lot of buy-in that way.
Right, because you want officers to know it's okay to be confidential, that it should be, but it's also okay to share and say, look, I got help. This is a resource that I want you to use, and this is how it worked for me. You have to, I imagine, walk that line.
For sure, yeah. And they do know that it's confidential because when this person stands up and kind of shares their journey and everybody else at the police department realizes that they didn't have any idea what they were going through, it proves the confidentiality in itself.
Hmm. Officer Felicia Labator, the peer support coordinator for the Kenosha Police Department, mother of the late Clay Davison, as we discuss the work to prevent suicide and to destigmatize mental illness, join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on the work of suicide prevention in law enforcement. A Justice Department report last year detailed the Kenosha Police Department's suicide prevention work. Acknowledging the subject of suicide is vast and daunting, but the approach to prevention can be straightforward and forthright. Education and awareness programs, the report said, vary from one police agency to the next. Join in 800-642-1234. Felicia Labator is peer support coordinator for the Kenosha Police Department and mother of the late Clay Davison. She stays with us. Let's take a call now. John is with us from Richland Center. John, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I think it's a good thing that we're bringing this to light nowadays, because the cops got a hard job, and we know there's good cops and there's bad cops. This is one way where the bad cops can get some help before they shoot somebody or strangle somebody's
John,
neck.
John, let's pause there. Felicia, what are your thoughts on how this can be a type of intervention before something bad happens?
Yeah, our team and the way we train other teams around the state is to notice those signs early on before it ends up affecting them at home or affecting them at work. So we can see those first signs of them being different or moody or whatever it may be, and be able to kind of be that bridge to offer support and to give them some resources. So, you know, we're also there in the crisis moment when maybe an officer could be suicidal and help prevent that as well. But we've seen it time and time again over the last, you know, 12 years that this program does work.
I want to ask you about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. They changed to 988 from the 10-digit phone number. And people now say, you know, they have the three-digit number for 24/7 crisis care. What do you think is the significance of this change?
Well, any way that we can make it easier for anyone to connect when they need help, right? So whether that was when the text line came out and people were texting, or if it's shortening a number, all of it is good. Because when you're in crisis, you know, you can't even think. It's been described to me that, you know, Felicia, I've been in these absolute pits, these dark holes, and it was everything I had to even reach out. And so the more easy that we can make it for anyone to be able to reach out to get help is great. That's what we want to do. That's why we created the Clay Davison Legacy Scholarship Fund. We created this because I want to be able to support anyone that wants to go into the field of mental health. You know, I'm sure you know this, in Wisconsin, there's such a shortage of mental health providers. You could wait up to 4 months with some people to get in. And we want to, you know, be able to, again, help people that are going into college that want to help other people. So yeah, we created the Clay Davison Scholarship Fund. I'm so proud of that.
The city of Kenosha has an employee assistance program for city employees to receive support, you know, whether it is a mental health crisis or a financial crisis or something else. What is your role in the work you're doing? Are there any connections there with the employee assistance program?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up. Yes, I've worked with our EAP. They are amazing. And we make sure that the therapists are vetted, because it's really important that if an officer or an officer's family is going to get any type of help, that therapist really understands the trauma of what it's like, excuse me, to be an officer. And so that they need some specific background in what we're dealing with. our city has been so gracious to us to provide us with these, with the EAP, and it gets used all of the time because it's not just for the officer, it's also for anybody in their household that lives with them. And we have a robust program because we get 8 visits where many, many departments only get 3 or 6. But as you can imagine, when you have so much trauma, you know, 3 visits just aren't going to do it. And so, yeah, we're very lucky to have what we have and the support of the city behind us.
We're talking about mental health support, focusing in on Kenosha, Kenosha Police Department Peer Support Team Coordinator, Officer Felicia Labator, with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Felicia, can you explain how chaplains work with the Kenosha Police Department and what their role is in helping with emotional support, mental health, and the role in the agency?
Yeah, we currently actually don't have any. It's not that we don't want any, we just don't have any right now. The ones that we've had in the past have been wonderful, but they're usually also pastors and of their own church and can be very busy, but they are a great addition. It is something that we teach and say it is, you need the peer support team, you need your therapist, you need chaplains. It's kind of that 3-prong approach because everybody gets help in different ways, right? And so we want to offer it in every way that we can, where somebody might connect with a therapist better and somebody might connect with the chaplain better.
We've seen federal funds, pandemic funds directed at the mental health crisis. Last year, $432 million in federal funds has spent to scale up crisis center capacity in the country. Do you think that is making a difference? Where should the money be going to?
That's a good question. I just think there's just not enough therapists out there. I feel like, you know, more and more people are open to getting therapy. And that's the stumbling block that I see, is that there's just not enough therapists to go around for people. So I think that they should be, you know, supporting people, kind of like what we're doing with the scholarship fund is helping people get through school. That's where I see the lack in the mental health.
Do you believe that your peer support team has helped save lives?
I know we have. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I know we have. You know, there's no greater feeling than knowing that you have intervened and helped somebody not actually take their own life, you know, as a department. And then obviously personally, us standing at 3 graves because of suicide, you know, you just want to do anything and everything you can to make sure that no one feels alone, right? Because mm-hmm. in their dark moments, they feel alone. And so that's why I'm so grateful. You know, I wake up every day and kind of say, what can I do today to help someone? And knowing that you guys are giving me this opportunity. And you know what, I hope and pray that we're going to save somebody's life today, that they're just going to hear our conversation and decide to live one more day and maybe call the number. So yeah, it's amazing.
Felicia, what about new officers to the force, new officers in the agency? Do you have one-on-one conversations? How do you introduce them to the resources besides, you know, saying, watch this video or something like that?
Yeah, no, we do. We have a whole onboarding program with them where they speak with me and our mental health wellness coordinator that I mentioned earlier. And we talk about pitfalls. You know, what are pitfalls in law enforcement that you can get into and how do you avoid them? And this is our EAP program. And we bring in other officers that, again, share their story and say, you can trust the team and you can trust going to these therapists. And so we get buy-in right away with the, you know, and it's obviously the younger generation that have grown up hearing more about mental health. So yeah, it's working. And I'm so excited that we're able to bring it and, you know, teach other departments around the state to do it as well.
Felicia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Kenosha Police Department Officer Felicia Labator coordinates the agency's peer support team promoting the mental health of law enforcement officers. She is the mother of Clay Davison, who died by suicide. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is a suicide prevention network of hundreds of crisis centers, provides 24/7 help to anyone in suicidal crisis or emotional distress. That hotline is 988. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in La Crosse. He's also one of the people featured in a new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted.
When Ernesto Rodriguez of La Crosse was 24 years old, he left the only home he'd ever known, Cuba.
And then when they ask me, do you want to leave Cuba? You go, yeah, because I don't want to be there.
He, along with 125,000 of his fellow Cubans, hopped on boats bound for the United States in 1980. They were part of the mass exodus known as the Mariel Boatlift, a rare moment when President Fidel Castro allowed residents to leave the island. Among that group that fled, almost 15,000 ended up at Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Erne. And while living there, Erne spent a lot of time in the kitchen. The staff were cooking the refugees American food, like hamburgers and hot dogs, food they hadn't developed a taste for yet. So a cook named Tony asked Erne a question.
And Tony asked me, what kind of food you guys like? It's Cuban food. I said, what the Cuban food? And then I show him like how to make a congee and a chicken fricassee and mashed potato, but not like mashed potato from here is different.
And it's in this kitchen that Erne met someone who was born and raised in Sparta, someone who had become family.
I'm just Brian Brandstetter. Erne's my brother from another mother.
Mm-hmm.
My family was one of the sponsors of Erne mm-hmm. back in 1980.
We are a good friend, we are a good brother because I love the guy like he's my own brother.
Well, I've been your brother longer than not. Yeah, 41 years, 1980, wow.
In order for Erne to get out of Fort McCoy, he had to find a sponsor who would vouch for him and help him find housing and a job. That's where the Brandstetters come in. Brian's parents, Roger and Annette Brandstetter, became Erne's sponsors. Erne went to live with the family in Sparta.
Yeah, they moved into my bedroom and they wore our clothes that they could fit in. My parents would go shopping for them. You know, they fed them. They gave them love.
Yeah, Mom. She was the best mom. I never have a mom.
Erne's new mom, Annette, is one of the most important people in his life.
I told her, my mom, every birthday, she making me an upside down pineapple cake. Every birthday.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say, Mom, I don't want this no more. You. And she called me, Renny, happy birthday. Come and get your cake. They said, wow, man, I'm lucky. Because they give me everything. I don't need nothing. They give me everything.
Roger got Erne a job at his car dealership. And this was a big deal, since it was not always easy for Cubans to find jobs.
And my dad had a very optimistic view. He goes, oh, we'll teach him English. We'll get him into church. We'll get him working.
But Brian says once they got to church, the new community wasn't necessarily welcoming of his new brother.
My parents lost a lot of their right-leaning friends because they're like, how could you do this? You let them into your house. You let them work for you. And it's crazy. They didn't feel good about it. Our mom was a very stern woman, and she wasn't going to take any crap from anybody. So she'd get all uppity, and she wouldn't care, and she'd create enemies.
Despite the pushback, Brian and Erne remained tight. They're family now.
Because nobody does that for a black guy in another country. and I always call you like my real mom.
Irne's journey to the United States wasn't easy. He's been through a lot, but he found sponsors who loved him and cared for him. Sponsors who would help him start a new life in Wisconsin. To learn more about Irne's life in Cuba, how he served in the military, was sent to prison, and took a treacherous boat ride to get to the United States, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes, plus historical photos, can be found at wpr.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And today at noon, Ernesto Rodriguez will join WPR Report's Uprooted co-hosts Maureen McCollum and Omar Granados for a live virtual event. Go to wpr.org/presents for details. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to St. John's Ministries in Green Bay. The Catholic Service Organization is set to open the city's first women-only shelter in a couple of weeks from now with 55 beds. Join in on housing instability and shelters for women, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lexi Wood is Executive Director of St. John's Ministries, which serves the homeless population in the Green Bay area and currently operates 2 seasonal shelters. Lexi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been Executive Director now for 10 years. How have you seen homelessness change in the Green Bay area over that time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm growing up within this role at St. John's. And so when I look back, you know, I started there in the summer of 2012. And so the first shelter season then that fall, we really were serving, it was still the impact of that recession. Mm-hmm. And I would often share with people, everybody at that time seemed to be taking a job one step down on the ladder just to get back to work. And for those that were the first rung of the ladder, you know, those entry level positions, they were just getting bumped off altogether. And so the population we served were job seekers with low job skills, perhaps with scattered work histories, not an advanced education. It really was a jobs issue. And, you know, compare that to today, it's certainly not a jobs issue. Anywhere you go, you see that they're hiring, and yet each of the shelters in town are seeing such high numbers. And so just that evolution, the complexities of certainly mental health and co-occurring disorders. And I would add into that, we're really seeing the impact of generational poverty, generational trauma. The population served within our shelter, and I would, you know, expand that to the other shelters in the community as well, has certainly changed over the last decade.
Tell us about Wellspring. What services will it provide and to whom?
Yep. So Wellspring is our daytime resource center specifically to women. That the daytime programs have been open for years. That was started by a group of Catholic sisters back decades ago. We acquired it from Lutheran Social Services in 2018. They were facing a budget shortfall and were going to close their doors. And at that point, we recognized we had a growing female population. There was significant unique needs to females that were homeless within a singles shelter environment compared to our men. And so we stepped in just feeling like our women needed something. I would say since we've acquired the Daytime Resource Center, we've certainly studied and come to understand those complex needs even better. And so Wellspring itself has been open. We moved it to a new location, tripled its square footage, but now the addition of an overnight shelter specific to women, the ability to serve both genders with gender-specific shelter, just allows us to respond to the unique needs of both men and women so much more intentionally, I would say, you know, moving forward.
How big of a conversion is it to take a daytime shelter and make it into an overnight shelter?
So the location that it's housed in was actually formerly our MICA Center, which was our co-ed daytime resource center. And the MICA Center, we were on a journey to expand the classroom size. We run employment training programs and various services. We had run out of room. And the construction bid came back just way too high. So we were looking at renovation costs of over $1 million for a building that we had bought for a few hundred thousand. Mm. And so we had set out just to see what is that worth in the community. We ended up just finding and being blessed with this amazing, beautiful building about a block and a half from our former facility. So we moved the MICA Center services over. We're now on the corner of Stewart and Monroe. And then we were sitting with a vacant property, wondering if we should try to sell it. There's, you know, certainly a lot of property available downtown. And that's when we looked to then convert it. And we ended up completely gutting it, remodeling it to house our women's programs. Wellspring previously had been on the west side of town across the river. So it was a complete gut and renovation. We put our daytime services on the north side of the building. We're able to put a 55-bed women's shelter on the south side. And somehow the economics of it all, that came in significantly less than had we kept MICA Center there and simply looked to expand the classrooms. Hmm. And so the economics behind it doesn't make sense, except to say we were absolutely blessed in that period. But because we completely gutted and renovated it, we were able to situate that building to meet our needs, you know, both with our daytime programs as well as the overnight.
What about children? Will children be accommodated in some way at Wellspring?
So St. John's programs, we serve individuals 18 and above. We see them as young as their 18th birthday. So we do not directly serve children. Okay. We partner with the other shelters in town, primarily, you know, Freedom House, House of Hope, Golden House, who do serve kids, who do serve families. That's their focus. And they do phenomenal work. We, I would say, serve those families indirectly. So by supporting mom, by supporting dad, whether that's through employment training programs and they're housed but facing housing instability, or, you know, with our female population, what we consistently see is due to mental health, due to addiction, due to housing, consistent housing instability, they're involved in the child welfare system. And so indirectly, we're supporting those kids by really helping mom and or dad get the supports and take the steps they need to hopefully one day be reunited. But within the shelter itself, our services are for those 18 and above.
Let's take a call. Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, it's interesting that the last program that you had talked about suicide, which I think is three times more that men commit suicide than women. And when you look at a homeless, overwhelmingly the number of homeless are men. It's a men issue. So in terms of male equity, why aren't we building more shelters to handle the men who are primarily the ones that are homeless?
Steve, thank you. Lexi, what is your take on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the majority of who we serve continues to be men. And so our primary homeless shelter is located about four or five blocks from this new women's shelter. Historically, that has been a co-ed shelter for homeless men and homeless women. And so this change, it's a focus, you know, certainly the focus with the new facility is looking at opening a women's specific shelter and our ability to provide care for that population. But what that does then is it allows us to take our larger shelter, our 84-bed facility, and expand that to be male specific. And so certainly we recognize there is a need. Our commitment, the majority of who we serve are homeless men. So I would say this shift allows us to serve both populations with great intentionality, with specific services and programs that serve those genders. I would echo Steve's comment. The one thing I'll share is when we look historically at the data, you know, over the last 10 years, the time I've been in leadership, our male numbers, well higher, have remained consistent. In that same period of time, our female numbers have grown by well over 100%. The first year that I was at St. John's Shelter, we averaged 4 women a night. This last year, we averaged 37 women a night.
Wow.
And so, well, again, the majority of our population continues to be male, we continue to do a lot of our programming centered on that male population, we also recognize there is a growing need with our female population that also requires our attention and support.
Lexi Wood has led St. John's Ministries in Green Bay for a decade as we learn about its work to open a women-only shelter on November 1st. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at efforts in Green Bay to address homelessness and the opening of a women's-only shelter. A new study finds Wisconsin lost at least $657 million last year due to domestic violence. That includes the cost of running shelters. That includes the cost of local programming and health care. That study commissioned by the Sojourner Family Peace Center. Still time to talk about homelessness. What's happening in your community? 800-642-1234. St. John's Ministries operates shelters in the Green Bay area, and Executive Director Lexi Wood stays with us. Lexi, let's turn to domestic violence. What role does domestic abuse have in causing homelessness?
I would certainly say there is a strong correlation. So for St. John's, so first of all, I'll back up and simply say that the Green Bay community is so resource rich. We have so many great partners doing phenomenal work. And so, you know, here in our community, we have a domestic violence shelter that does phenomenal work. And yet what I consistently hear from them as a shelter is they really have to prioritize the intakes around those who have immediate risk, just because domestic violence permeates through so many cases of those experiencing homelessness. And that goes across both genders. And so at St. John's, we look at it, we say one of three camps. About 85% of our female population discloses they've been victims of domestic violence or sexual abuse at the point of intake. Many of our men as well. We know that statistically, that's likely going to be an underreported number. And it could fall again into one of three categories. Either it's childhood abuse, what they witnessed, what they experienced that really shapes their development and impacts them throughout the course of their life. What people often think of kind of the second camp is an individual who's in an abusive relationship, who's looking to flee that relationship. And that is the direct reason for that episode of homelessness. Or I'd say probably what we, you know, experience certainly on a daily basis are individuals who in their struggle, in their housing instability, have sought out very unhealthy relationships as a means to get their needs met. And so this person's offering me shelter, I'm going to stay here. And then very quickly, that unhealthy relationship turns physical and abusive in other ways. And so I share that just to say it's hard to track it simply because how are we gathering the questions and what are we looking at just to say what role has domestic violence specifically played here in this case of homelessness?
With that said, how do you coordinate or how do you collaborate with other shelters in the area that might not do the specific work that you do?
So here in our community, the group of shelters work very closely, are in close partnership to make sure, one, that individuals and households are served, and that, two, we really are looking to link them to the program and the shelter that's going to be able to best meet their needs. And so we kind of each take a different piece of the pie. There's lots of collaboration happening through the coalition, through other work groups. And so there's just the big thing is to ensure consumer choice, to make sure the guests have a voice in this story, where so often when you are struggling and you're dependent on services and government aid, you don't have a voice. And so to make sure they have a voice, but then to make sure that we are advocating for their specific needs instead of generalizing that story and grouping it into a population or a subgroup that may be so easy to do. It's really important to keep it client-centered.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Green Bay's shelters, Green Bay opening its first shelter for homeless women. Lexi Wood is Executive Director of St. John's Ministries, 800-642-1234. Lexi, you mentioned that the Green Bay area is resource rich. What about funding? Where does St. John's Ministries get funding to provide these services?
So ironically, St. John's, we chose probably about 5-6 years ago to walk away from all government aid. And that was a very intentional decision we made, because when you're reliant on government funding, it certainly it's abundant. There are many streams of funding that can support your work, but you are then required to make sure your programs and your mission are hitting certain targets, to hitting certain outcomes, but also your eligibility can shift to meet the funding source. And we really felt strongly that we need to stay true to our mission, and to do so, we need to make sure that is untainted by trying to appease funders that may disagree. So in the Green Bay community, we rely solely on private support, individuals who support us, households that support us, businesses. We write for local grants. But my real quick example, I guess, of why we chose to do this, how this plays out, is in Washington, D.C., there can be conversations between different departments. The one that was kind of the final straw for us was a conversation between HUD, which is the housing division, and the Department of Justice, which is the criminal justice system. And so there was this fight happening in D.C. to create better exit plans for inmates, to which I would absolutely wholeheartedly agree. And yet how it was played out is, if you received their funding, you could not serve somebody who is being released from the criminal justice system, because they wanted them to have better reentry plans. Well, great in theory, St. John's is a shelter of last resort, looking to ensure that people are not on the streets in harsh winter elements. And we were being told that until they were literally homeless, so until they had spent a night on the streets, they did not qualify for shelter programs at the point they're at the door. And so decisions like that, we chose to walk away from government funding and instead rely on private support. That being said, we are in the strongest financial position we've ever been because of the support of our community.
Lexi, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lexi Wood is Executive Director of St. John's Ministries, serving homeless people in the Green Bay area, operating two seasonal shelters. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.